And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today by Yaniv Bernstein. You know, we were talking about how to introduce him. I think he's just a serial entrepreneur. And like a lot of us, he's got entrepreneurial ADHD, done a bunch of different things. Today, he spends a lot of time helping other startups, even has his own podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about a line that he said before we started recording I really liked. You got to know the startup game and you got to know the rules of the game. And excited to talk about some of the bigger problems that a lot of startups have and how we can help solve those. If one of those problems is hiring a dev team, you can always check us out at Fullscale. We have over 300 employees in the Philippines doing all kinds of software development, front end, back end, mobile, QA, whatever it is you need help with. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Yaniv, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Matt. Really excited to be here.
Is it a fair statement? We have entrepreneurial ADHD.
I'd say I've acquired entrepreneurial ADHD late in life. I've actually went through a fairly traditional kind of career earlier on. I was at Google for 10 years and, you know, trying to climb the ladder and everything. And at some point, I realized that wasn't for me anymore. And I've kind of backed into it. And, you know, now that I'm in startups and building different things, it's actually something I talk to my wife about sometimes. It feels difficult to go back to the idea of, you know, just having a single steady job.
It sounds super hard, right? And then, you know, when you're doing something entrepreneurial related, it always feels like you're in problem solving mode, right? And like you see other problems like, oh, I could do this thing, or I could do this thing, or I could do this thing, or I want to invest in this thing. It's always a little bit of a struggle, I feel like.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, having recently left the startup where I was a full-time founder, I'm now building up. I've got like three different things that I'm juggling and definitely feeling the ADHD right now where it's like it's really easy to overcommit because there are so many exciting opportunities, which, you know, I'm enjoying at the moment.
So is one of those three things your podcast or is that the fourth thing?
No, the podcast is one of those things because it absolutely aligns with my mission and what we're going to talk about today, right, which is that I've also, you know, in addition to the entrepreneurship and all that, I've done a lot of advising and angel investing, and I get exposure to a lot of startups. And I see fantastic founders making the same mistakes over and over again. And I always say, Matt, like, there's two kinds of mistakes that you need to make. Well, sorry, there's two kinds of mistakes that you can make as a founder. There are the ones that you have to make yourself. You know, you have to learn the hard way, right? The sort of school of hard knocks. And then there are the avoidable mistakes, the mistakes that you just don't really need to be making. And I hope to help people make fewer of that second kind of mistake so they can focus on making the first kind of mistake and really build a valuable enterprise. And you know, the podcast is definitely related to that. So that's called the Startup Podcast. Yeah.
So sometimes I liken this to being a parent. It's like you can also read all the parenting books in the world, but until you have children, none of it makes any sense. And so this is coming also from a guy who has five children.
A lot of children.
And you know, it always drives me nuts, especially when people that don't have kids always have these opinions about how a parent should do this and do that. It's like, you have no idea. Just stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are so many things in life that you just don't understand until you go through them. But the thing is, I think you want to at least try and catch people, hopefully when they're like, partway through it, right? They're like, man, I know this is a problem. I know I need some help, like parenting help or startup help, whatever it is. I probably need help. Are there resources that can help me before I make a bunch more mistakes? Like, I can feel that I need help.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I actually really love the parenting analogy. I think it applies in so many ways to being a founder as well. But I think that's, I agree with you. Really, what we were saying there is, some things you just got to learn the hard way. You can't get the book learning. So what I really focus on is like you said, the knowing what game you're playing and knowing the rules of the game. And yeah, I'm thinking on the fly whether the parenting analogy applies to that. I think there's an element where it is, which is like, how do you want your kid to turn out? Like, what to you does it look to raise a decent human being? Or, you know, do you want your child to be a high achiever or whatever, right?
Well, it makes perfect sense, actually, because I want to get more into this, talking about startups and knowing the game, and probably there are different games, right?
Mm-hmm.
With kids, there are different games. I have five kids. All five of them are totally different.
Yeah.
None of them are playing the same game either, right? I have one that has all sorts of anxiety problems, and I have another one that has like ADHD, and it's like very absent-minded. I mean, they have all the problems, right? And they are all totally different. And they all have like different guardrails I'm hoping that they can stay in and be successful in their life, right? But startups are the same way, right? So I guess the question is, what are the different startup games? Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that there are multiple layers. And I think the big one at the top is really, do you want to go down the bootstrapped path or down the venture capital path? I think that is a big one. And, you know, my podcast is actually more focused on the venture capital path, but I would, having said that, you know, I think venture capital is incredibly powerful for the right sort of startup. But I think because it's sort of glamorous in a sense, it gets a lot of media attention. People talk about, you know, oh, I've raised a seed and a Series A and a Series B. It often seems to become the default path. And it's important to remember, right, you know, in terms of starting businesses and all of history is a vast, vast, vast majority of businesses are bootstrapped and, you know, you build them up slowly. And so software and tech is a special place where the venture model can work really well, but you need to satisfy a few criteria and you need to play the game a certain way. And so I think the biggest mistake I see is founders saying, oh, well, of course, I need to go raise some capital, without understanding all of the riders that come along with that, all of the different things that you're actually choosing a game. And, you know, and bootstrapping, similarly, I think people often don't understand what it takes to successfully bootstrap. You've got a completely different set of rules, especially early on. And you need to make a conscious choice and a conscious commitment to which game that you're playing.
So I originally played the bootstrap game, like my first company when I was 22 years old, exited in 29 when I was 29 years old. We grew it to 30 million a year in revenue, all bootstrapped.
Yeah.
And
congratulations.
We were also in the
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we were also went through like the 2008-2009 sort of recession where it was nearly impossible to raise money and all that kind of stuff. We actually wanted to raise money and we would have been one of the perfect companies to invest in at that time. And I don't think the VC world was quite as sophisticated then as it is now either. Like we would have had probably a lot easier time. But I love your description of understanding the game and the game that you're getting into. And I think I would love to hear from you, your perspective of if somebody's listening to this right now and they're like, yeah, I want to go raise VC money. How do you explain to them if their company is even one that could go down that path? Like, what is the criteria that you think of?
So I start by understanding the game that the VCs are playing, right? Because what you're doing really is you're signing up to their game. And the game they're playing is a game of power law returns. What that means is, if you imagine you're a venture capitalist, right? You also have your own bosses, which is your limited partners, your investors. And they're expecting you to give them at least a 3x return on their fund. And the way that tends to work is they say, well, the conventional wisdom, at least, is you have this sort of power law distribution, which means most of the companies fail. You have a few that do okay and, you know, kind of give you your money back or double your money or whatever. And then you have a small number of companies that hit it out of the park, right? And in general, the idea is you should have at least one company in your portfolio that does what's called returning the fund, which means just the returns from that single company is enough to cover the entire fund. So if you've got a $100 million fund, that one company, just your share in it as an investor, needs to be worth $100 million and needs to exit at that. So what that means is venture capitalists are playing this game of the high risk, high reward. They're saying, we're investing in companies. We're comfortable that a lot of them will fail. We don't even care, in a sense, that a lot of them will fail. but they each company that we invest in needs to have the potential to be huge, right? So they really have this sort of extreme distribution, this exponential distribution of their returns. And so that means that if you take their money, you're signing up to that. It means you need to say, I am willing and able to risk it all to 100x the valuation of my company. I'm taking money at a 5 million valuation. I need to be worth at least $500 million. I need to have the potential to do it. And so suddenly the option of, you know, getting to 5 million ARR and everyone getting a nice salary and a distribution and just growing 5% a year, that option is cut off to you, right? You are there to massively scale. And so then the venture capitalists are looking at you and they're saying, can you reach that 100x scale or more, right? And that means you need to have a business that's scalable. So then you're talking about, you know, addressing a large market, having very high leverage, high margins, things like that. If you don't have that, and you know, actually, if I may sort of as a quick aside, there are only two industries in the world really these days that are use venture capital, and that is software and tech, and then biotech, basically coming up with new drugs and things like that.
Pharmaceuticals,
right? And yeah, the two things that those have in common, right, is first of all, very high upfront costs, right? You need to do a lot of work on the development, but then very, very low marginal costs, right? In both cases, it's basically intellectual property. And, you know, once you have a drug that's FDA approved or whatever, you can print or whatever, you can manufacture a lot of that drug for pretty cheap compared to what it costs. Similarly for software, right? It scales infinitely, really easily. So what you're doing is, why are you taking venture capital? Because you need to spend some money upfront to create something like a money printing machine, I call it sometimes. You're building the money printing machine. Until it's ready, it prints no money. Once it's ready, you can print a lot of money. And that is what venture capital is looking for. But that is only one path when you're an entrepreneur in software or anything.
So my concern with this is, if this VC fund is going to do 10 investments, like you said, they're looking for like basically grand slams out of all of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like a single or a double is not sufficient. And the problem is, I feel like they have to push all 10 of those companies to the brink of breaking to figure out if they're going to get that grand slam or not, because they can't just let them kind of meander around and then maybe get a double. Like they've got to push them to the breaking point, right? Where they know like, okay, five or six of them are going to totally fail, but a couple of them will get that grand slam. And I know these five or six are going to be casualties, but I know these two are going to hit that grand slam, and then three others, or they'll kind of meander around and we'll get some kind of return out of them, but it won't be spectacular. Does that make sense? Because that's what I don't like about it, is I feel like it pushes them to the breaking point.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, there's this great Jeff Bezos quote. He says, you know, in baseball, you hit a really good, or whatever, you know, in baseball, you can get a home run, right? You can get four runs. That's the most you can get. He said, in business, sometimes you hit the ball and you can get 1,000 runs. And I think that's really cool, right? So it's, in fact, it's an unlimited game. And that's the point of what the VCs are playing. They want you to get 1,000 runs. We get a grand slam, right? And, you know, my experience with VCs is, when you say they push you to breaking point, they're not pushing you. Like, generally, the pressure that I've seen applied by VCs is pretty gentle, but it's more, again, about the game that you're being opted into and your exit options, right? So, like, if you meander along and you never get to that 1,000x scale, the VCs are not necessarily going to, like, ride you and, you know, give you a hard time and so on. What they're going to do is block off your exit possibilities, right? What you can't do, like I said, is suddenly say, hey, you know what, we're profitable, and so we're just going to return a dividend, a distribution to all of our owners. They're not interested in that game. They say, no, invest that money back in the business and try to keep growing. And so it's again, it's not necessarily a question of them saying, you know, having completely unrealistic expectations, but it's a way of thinking about it. Like I said, they've blocked off the exits. So suddenly you're in a tunnel, and the only way out is like the light right at the end of the tunnel, which is your 100x return. And if you do less than that, you as a founder are not going to have a sort of a comfortable life and a, you know, optionality. And, you know, sometimes VCs call these bootstrapped or other businesses lifestyle businesses. And it's often that's used as a kind of a negative. It's like, oh, you know, it's belittling that type of business. But it's like, damn, like who doesn't want to have a good lifestyle? What you're really saying about venture-backed is you are sacrificing the ability to have a great lifestyle for the opportunity to get that grand slam, to really have an impact. And it's about people who have that passion to go big. That is the right time to opt into that game. And, you know, I often ask founders, you know, if I'm angel investing or just advising them, I'm like, would you rather have a 30% chance of creating a $50 million business or a 5% chance of creating a $1 billion business? And if they say, I want the $1 billion business, I'm willing to leave it all out on the field. And I'm like, great, go raise capital. But that's, again, that's the game that you're playing.
But I think there are also these weird moments where you feel like you have something that could be a $1 billion company, right? And so it doesn't feel like 5%. It feels more like 20%, 40%, 50%. Versus, like, if you told me, hey, do you think there's a 5% chance that Full Scale could be a $1 billion company? I'd probably be like, no, probably not. I would never take that bet, right? But if I'm like, okay, I invented this like AI thing that's going to revolutionize the world and I can see it, you know, going bonkers and whatever, I invented the next version of Ozempic that's going to be better than semaglutide or whatever. And you're like, okay, I think this is the one I'm going to go all in on. Right. Like, but those are and that is really the only thing that VCs are looking for. The big VCs, like the big well-known VCs, those are the opportunities, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, so you're saying people overestimate their chances of success. You're probably right. And I think that's where it's important to be really clear-eyed about it. There's a fantastic book called Super Forecasting by a guy called Philip Tetlock. And he sort of talks about, you know, what it takes to be really good at estimating and predicting the future, and not in a sort of weird crystal ball way, but like, you know, what's the chance that there's going to be that World War III is going to start in the next 10 years, that sort of thing. And, you know, one of the things is people are really bad at that, about, you know, making probabilistic predictions about the future. And one of the best remedies to it is what's called using the base rate. So it's like, instead of saying, hey, you know, I'm sure I'm building the next Ozempic and I've got a 50% chance of building a $1 billion company, as you say, what percentage of startups of my stage reach a $1 billion valuation? And it's probably 1%.
Yeah.
And all of those founders think they're the 1%. So it's sort of like a really good reality check. It's like the base rate is probably more accurate. You're probably more like your group characteristic than you are about, you know, unique to yourself. And so, you know, I still think I wouldn't want to discourage people from this. Again, it's not saying this is a bad game. I think it's a great game. The other thing to say is it's iterative, right? So what you find with the venture game especially is quite often your first startup doesn't hit, the second one doesn't hit, but you also learn, you slowly improve your percentage probability of success. And eventually you can build that business that you want to, right? And so it's a little bit different to this idea that, you know, with bootstrapped is you grind it out, you hang in there, you slowly build it up over time, and eventually you have a reasonable chance of having a good, successful business that brings in the cash. With venture-backed, it's kind of like go big or go home. You actually want to treat it as a sequence, right? It's like, well, I'll do everything I can to make this business succeed, but if it fails, it doesn't mean I've failed. It doesn't mean I've lost my one shot at it. It means I try again and again.
I mean, one of the other things I don't like about venture-backed companies is I kind of feel like they're playing the game of chicken. And what I mean by that is it's sort of like you're running towards a brick wall or you're playing the game of chicken. They're like, okay, we're going to give you the $10 million. You've got to go hire all these people. You've got to go hit all these numbers. You got to grow. And then as long as you hit these numbers, we'll give you more money. Mm. But if you don't hit these numbers, bam, you hit the brick wall and you're done, right? Like, that's the part of it I really don't like is, right, if they give you all the money, like, you got to go spend it. You got to go invest all this money, go hire all the people, go do all the things, go grow, 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 grow. And you know you only've got a certain amount of runway, right? Now, granted, there are scenarios where this isn't true. You've got these scenarios where they're like really reputable founders that raise the money in kind of a different way, and they're like, we're going to be the next Facebook, and anybody who invests in us is lucky, and we're not, you know, doing this stupid games. We're doing things a little slower and methodical, but we own this market and whatever, right? But I think those are the more rare cases. The rest of them are kind of this like running towards the brick wall, I feel like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. And this is where, you know, we talked at the beginning about my, I guess, my mission of educating founders around the rules of the game. Because while there are quite a lot of rules of the VC game, that running at the walls, that's not one of the rules. I think that is something that less experienced or less educated founders can be pushed into doing, but they don't have to, right? So the way of thinking about how venture capital works is you have these multiple rounds. You do not, it is not one of the rules of the game that you need to go all the way up to a Series D, right? If you raise a pre-seed round and that's enough to get you to escape velocity, you never have to raise again. If you raise a pre-seed and then a seed, that gets you to escape velocity, you never have to raise again. You actually get to have agency in when you stop that VC merry-go-round and say, no more, I'm not raising any more money. And that, you know, obviously some of this is just to do with the dynamics and the structure of your own business, the economics of your business. But yes, good founders, I actually wanted to say another thing, which is unless you have raised from a VC who is not reputable, you as the founder maintain control over your company. So VCs cannot tell you what to do. They can advise you, they can encourage you. I guess if they're not so nice, they can sort of bully you a bit, but they cannot make you, right? They're minority owners. You're a majority owner. You have a control. They have a, you know, not a non-controlling stake. And so I think it's important to say, you know, the other side of that is less experienced founders often feel this weight of responsibility that actually isn't there, right? Which is to say, I've taken somebody else's money and therefore I need to listen to them. You know, it's this sort of very holy thing where I feel this crushing weight. I've taken $5 million from somebody and therefore, you know, they own me. And it's like, no, they have made a speculative investment. And going back to that power law and returning the fund, the flip side of that is the VCs are comfortable if you lose all their money as well, as long as you do it in a good faith attempt to build that scaled thing, right? And so you really need to be like, okay, they've invested in me and now it's up to me. I can take their advice, but it's up to me to use this money in service of this high risk bet that they've made in me. And that doesn't mean that you have to spend it all. You know, I think in 2021, things got a bit crazy, sure. But yeah, the best founders and the ones sometimes who have a bit more experience or, you know, who listen to the right podcasts, right, Matt? Are like, okay, I don't have to just go blitz scaling and hire all my money, like, you know, spend all my money hiring. And I'm seeing more and more startups saying, oh, you know, we've still got 48 months runway because, you know, we raised that money and we're burning it very slowly. So nobody is making you spend all that money, run at the wall, except yourself. And I think that is absolutely true. It does happen a lot.
Well, if you want to save 60 to 70% on hiring, you can check us out at Full Scale. If you're looking to hire software developers, no matter what kind of programming language it is, front end, mobile, QA, all the different things, check us out at fullscale.io. It's my company. We work with about 60 different companies, building all kinds of cool stuff, venture-backed, bootstrapped, old boring companies, all of them. So
yeah, I think that actually, just to segue off that little promo, I think that one of the healthy things that's happening in the venture-backed space at the moment is because we had 2021 and everything went crazy, and yes, people thought money was free and easy, and then things got tough. The current breed of venture-backed startups are much more careful with their money. They realize that they can't just keep going back to the well. And so what I see is much more of a focus on cost. You know, making big bets and taking big risks doesn't mean wasting money. If anything, it means the opposite. It means that, you know, if you're trying to build a $1 billion company and you only have so many at bats, right, you need to make sure you need to maximize the number of shots that you get. And that means being really sensible with the money that you've raised.
So from your perspective, if I go get a big name VC, are they going to bring me more than just their name and their money? Are they actually going to bring me advisors, help, networking, customers, or are they just dumb money?
So they're not dumb money, but because dumb money are the ones who give you bad advice and expect you to follow it. They're smart money. And, you know, all of these big VCs, they have these divisions, whatever they call them, like portfolio success, where they offer a variety of services to the companies that they invest in. My personal experience is that the value add there is marginal. And, you know, the best VCs I've spoken to, like one of them I had on my podcast, I'm like, so, you know, what's a controversial opinion you have? That's what I asked him. And he said, VCs add very little value beyond the money. And this was a really, you know, a top tier VC. And, you know, I think it is true. Ultimately, it's good to be clear eyed that the transaction is they're investing money in you in return for equity, and the rest is up to you. But yes, they, you know, they do provide access to network. My experience has been that it's fairly self-serve, by which I mean the resources are available to you, but you need to figure out how to make use of them. Sometimes I wish they'd be more opinionated, where they say, this is how you should do it. But usually it's more like a buffet. It's like, oh, you know, we've got a recruitment person. You know, if you're looking to hire a VP, then they can help you. And, you know, we have these seminars on like how to set up an ESOP or anything like that. But no, I think it is worth understanding. Thing number one is the money. Thing number two, to your point, Matt, is probably the brand. Like if you can raise from a very well-known VC, that does open doors. And then number three is everything else.
Well, I can also tell you from firsthand experience, sometimes that VC or private equity that you get involved with, that fund is trying to make money off of you through some of those things too, right? They're trying to sell you different services, get you to hire their development team or whatever it is, because they're actually profiting on it. I've actually seen that.
I would generally consider that to be a low quality investor, because I think, you know, they are, it's a conflict of interest. They're not playing a pure game, right? A pure VC is saying, I'm making a bunch of bets and I'm going to make my money back by maximizing the probability that one of them hits or that, that enough of them hit. Whereas these guys are like, you know, they're giving you money with one hand, they're taking it with the other hand. It's like, what game are you playing? Like, it feels exploitative. It doesn't feel like they actually have aligned interests, which is to make sure, for example, that you hire the best developers rather than their developers or whatever it is, right?
Right. So
I would actually avoid investors like that if I could.
So when you talk about knowing the VC game, what other suggestions do you have about knowing the VC route, the VC game?
I mean, there's a bunch of tactical stuff, but I think fundamentally it is about, like I said, I kind of like this image. You're in a tunnel. If you bootstrap, there are all these little exits along the side of the tunnel that you can say, oh, well, you know, I just want to make enough money to put my kids through school, or I, you know, I want to make enough money to be rich or whatever, or, you know, I want to be able to do a small trade sale or whatever. VC, you are sealing off all those exits. The only way out of the tunnel is all the way through. And that's the game. So then the question is, you need to then reflect on yourself. I actually think a lot of it is, it's self-reflection and knowing yourself, right? It's like, is that what I want to do? If so, if you're obsessed with your business, if you're like, I think it could be big. I actually like it. You have to believe it is going to be big, and you have to convince the VCs that it could be big, or else they won't invest in you. But it's actually more about, what are your motivations? Because if your motivation is just to make a comfortable lifestyle, a comfortable living, then the VC path is not the right way. At a certain point, you say, or even if you want to become a billionaire, the VC path is not the right way, because the probabilities are low, the odds are against you. Honestly, you're probably better off becoming a VC or like going into banking, investment banking or something, if you just want to get really rich. It's if you've fallen in love with the problem and you're obsessed with it and you want to be able to build something amazing that we sometimes say makes a bit of a dent in the universe, that's when you should do it. Because then you leave it all out in the field, and if you fail, you're just going to go back in there and try again anyway.
Hey, the odds of you becoming a billionaire probably means at the end of this, you only owned 10 or 20% of the company probably, right? After 11 rounds of funding and all this different stuff that goes on. So that means that you're going to build a company that's worth $5, $10 billion. Like, it's going to be a giant company for you to end up owning a billion.
You know, 10% of a billion is still a lot of money, of course.
It is.
And, you know, the other thing I'd say is I have not found many places beyond venture-backed startups as incredible learning opportunities. Everything's kind of in sort of, it's sped up, it's in fast forward. And so it's a great place to learn. And, you know, another way of thinking about it is, like I said, I've just moved on from one of the venture-backed startups that I co-founded. The business is actually still going. But I have learned so much from being a part of that. And I think that opens a whole bunch of opportunities to me to work with other businesses. And, you know, it's just an incredible upskilling. So I think if you go into it with your eyes open and understand what you're doing, there's a lot of positive to it. But what breaks my heart is when people are looking to raise money and they don't even understand why, what they're doing, you know, how does it align with their goals? But, you know, I mean, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Matt, but so much of it, it does become personal because actually maybe we can, this is a good time to return to the parenting analogy, right? Because other than your own kids and your own family, your own business is probably something that, you know, as a founder is incredibly personal and incredibly consuming of your time and of your energy and of your life force, right? And so when you do that, you need to think to yourself, what sort of life am I building for myself? I think it's actually a mistake to abstract yourself away from it. It's really quite a personal decision that involves a bit of, you know, work on yourself to make that decision well.
Well, so my first company was bootstrapped, and I think there's a big difference between being bootstrapped and it being kind of a bootstrap sort of lifestyle business as well, right? So we were still a very high growth company. We were doubling in revenue every year. We had no working capital. I mean, we had no money in the bank. We had none of it, right? And so, you know, our working capital was basically not paying our bills.
Yeah.
You just don't pay any of your bills.
It's a time-tested technique.
Yeah.
Great way to build the
And so that was the reality of the world we were in. And we were growing so fast, but we didn't have like proper funding. But, you know, at that time I made like $100,000 a year, $120,000 a year, which wasn't bad. And this is like 2008, 2009, 2010, or it wasn't bad. But I had salespeople that made like $400,000 a year that were amazing. And so, you know, that's awesome. But as a guy who like, you know, oh, you own this part of this company, you should be worth like millions of dollars or whatever. I'm like, dude, I don't make much of, I have software developers that make more than I do. And I'm the, you know, CTO of the company and founder, you know, one of the owners. I'm eating hot dogs and paying you guys steak. Right?
Yeah.
And,
sorry, go on.
And that, but that's different than say like using Full Scale as an example where we're like, okay, this is like a steady growth company. We're growing 20, 30% a year. It's profitable. It's a little more of a, you know, cash flow business. Could be a little more of a lifestyle business, right? It's not like this rapid, you know, for my first company, even though it was bootstrapped, it was growing extremely fast. Like it's kind of hard to believe how fast we were growing and being bootstrapped.
Yeah. I actually think I learned something from you there. I think you're right. The categorization is a little bit subtle, right? Which is there is, yeah, I think people don't like the term lifestyle business, but I guess you could say there are these, maybe nearly another way of thinking about it is a traditional business. A traditional business is around compounding cash flows, right? You grow steady, you grow profitably. Every year you make a bit more money than you made the year before. And then there are high growth businesses like your first one. Now, it's actually, it's always true. You know, when I said, the rules of the game doesn't mean you have to raise six rounds of venture capital. To your point, depending on your life circumstances, you don't have to raise, and the business, you don't have to raise any rounds of venture capital, right? So in fact, it's the ideal. If you're building a high growth business and you don't raise venture capital, it means you don't get diluted. You don't have all of this noise, other voices in your ear. You get to do it your way. I think why venture capital plays an important role in the ecosystem is a lot of businesses or a lot of people are not in a position to grow to be a high growth business without that initial series of capital injections. I mean, what you did is the highest degree of difficulty, right? It's like you build a high growth business without taking any outside money. That's a very narrow path to navigate. But sure, you know, it's true. When we talk about venture-backed businesses, it's really a shortcut for saying high growth, non-lifestyle businesses where, you know, this is not about building a comfortable living. This is about building something big. You know, you can call it the rocket ship. And that sounds like exactly what you did that first time.
It was. And we were very fortunate for a lot of reasons and definitely learned a lot from it. I spent my whole 20s basically doing that. So
really impressive.
But I think most companies, if you're thinking about, as like you said, a standard business is just trying to grow profit every year, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. we made $1 million last year. How do I make $1.5 million this year or whatever? And just steady compounding growth. But I don't know that most SaaS like bootstrap companies really fall into that category either. I feel like they're somewhere in the middle. They're not as crazy as my first company. They're not like trying to really make profit either. They're trying to just grow at a sustainable rate, kind of near break even, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, you know, another one of our podcast Another startup podcaster, Rob Walling, he runs Startups for the Rest of Us, and he also has a fund called Tiny Seed. And, you know, he's really about, I think he calls it mostly bootstrapped companies. He likes to give small amounts of seed capital to companies that are not looking to raise again, just one-off bit of capital, which is why it's called Tiny Seed. And I think that actually speaks to the fact that although I presented this as black or white, bootstrapped or venture-backed, it's actually a bit more, there are shades of gray, right?
Oh, yeah.
And yes, there is the like, I want to be able to eat steak from the very first year. You know, I'm focusing on maximum kind of lifestyle, maximum kind of returns from an early stage versus I'm trying to compound something big. And from that point of view, yes, it's about like, How far in the future have you pushed your profits? Because that's the other thing to remember, that sometimes folks who have like drunk too much of the venture-backed Kool-Aid can forget is that eventually, you know, assuming you're a for-profit enterprise, every business is there to generate profits. So the question isn't, are we going to be profitable? The only question is, when are we going to be profitable? And, you know, it can
sometimes be... Sometimes it's a choice. It's a choice.
Yeah, it often is a choice, right? It can be this year, or you can say, you know, if you're bootstrapping, like you said, Matt, we can be taking every bit of extra revenue and putting it straight back into the business. And again, paying yourself a below market salary as a CEO just to keep things rolling. But you're doing that because you think that the value that will accrue to you in the future will be bigger if you invest in growing that business. And in 10 years from now, you're going to have a great big business that you can sell or that you can take big fat checks out of every year.
Well, and actually the way our tax code works, we're incentivized to grow, right? So if Full Scale makes $1 million in profit this year, I'm going to have to pay like 40% of that in tax. Mm. Or I can invest $1 million in growth, basically at a 40% discount or whatever, and go invest the whole million. Right. And invested in the growth. So it's kind of weird when you think about it that way, though.
Yeah. And I've heard there are entrepreneurs who borrow cash against the value of their business to fund their living expenses, because that way they defer that taxable moment.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. If you can invest, you know, trying to reduce all the taxable income and funnel it into growth. But like Full Scale is an example of a type of business, though, that you wouldn't necessarily do that with. Like it just doesn't make as much sense to do. And even a company like Full Scale, which is a dev agency, when we started out, we hired about 100 people in the first year. And you're like, well, a dev agency should be profitable. It shouldn't need to raise money. But somebody's got to pay for 100 computers and 100 desks. An office, mm-hmm. you know, an office space and all this stuff. So we still had to have some kind of capital, you know, even in the beginning of the company. Or if we would have been like, oh, we're going to hire 5 people, like we would have like bootstrapped through the 5 people, right? But, you know, I think that's where there's so many shades of gray of like even a company like Full Scale. It's like, we don't need to go raise millions of dollars, but it's like, oh, we need to buy 100 laptops. Like you need, you know, some kind of funding to go do that, or you have to grow a lot slower.
That's right. So, outside capital can accelerate growth. Accelerating growth makes sense if the margins on that growth are very high, right? So that's sort of the calculation that you need to go through. And I think, you know, what I've learned, you know, coming, my background's as a software engineer and, you know, more on the product side of things. And so then going into business, I think one of the things that was a weakness for me is, oh, okay. And for a lot of people I see who come from that side of the world is doing the analysis, the financial analysis, right? Where it's like, okay, how are the economics of my business? Is it actually a high margin business that I can accelerate and scale using software if I have upfront capital? Or is it a low margin business that I can't scale effectively, in which case taking outside capital is the wrong thing to do, right? Because what you want to do is compound that. And, you know, for example, you know, you run a dev agency, I'd say that you consider that like a medium margin business, right? It's like the margins are not the same as if you were building a SaaS. And so that dictates the sorts of decisions that you make in growing your business. It doesn't mean it's a worse business. It means it's a different business, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you don't have to have an MBA or anything like that, but just understanding the basics of like, what's the economic engine of your business and what implications are there for how you grow it, how you fund it? I think that's actually really important, because I see folks are like, I've got a great idea. I need to raise $1 million of seed capital to build it. And then you look at it and it's like, you're never like, the economics of this business are not suitable for venture. So you are going to really frustrate yourself. And Matt, it breaks my heart, because what I see is these very earnest, dedicated founders who are bootstrapping in the sense that they're self-funding this business that they're building. But they know that, well, they think that they need to raise outside capital. So they're spending their life savings. They're building this thing. It's not profitable. And they're like, I just need to raise this round. And I feel like, you know, the best thing that a lot of these folks could do is have someone pull them aside and say, you are never going to be able to raise that round. And so you need to reevaluate what you're doing now in the light of that before you waste years, again, of your life and your energy building something that has, you know, that has shaky foundations, that's never really going to stand up.
Yep. Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. I think this was a fantastic conversation about VCs and bootstrapping and all the different intricacies of it. I do want to remind everybody that today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale. If you need help doing software development, we specialize in building dev teams for other people. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Yaniv, tell us more about what you're doing and how people can learn more and how you can help them.
Yeah, so I'm doing a few things. So first of all, do you mind if I talk about my podcast? I don't want to.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, I've got a podcast. It's called The Startup Podcast. It's in all your major listening apps. You can also find us on TSP for the Startup Podcast .show, where you'll have links to all the episodes, all the listening, all the different listening apps there. And like I was saying, our focus there is really to help founders understand the game that they're playing. So we have an episode every week where we dive deep on a topic. Sometimes myself and my co-host Chris, sometimes we'll bring on a guest who's an expert on that topic. So, you know, we'll cover all sorts of things, including, of course, how to hire a dev team. So, you know, you can sort of use it as a library of different topics for how to understand the rules of the game that you're playing. I've also started with another partner, a business called Funding Fit, fundingfit.co, where we're really helping businesses that are looking to go down that venture path get their story straight and understand how to run a fundraising process. So that's a small cohort-based intensive course to really help people get the fundraise right, because that's another thing I see is people, again, there's this massive information asymmetry, right, where the VCs know how a raise works and the founder, first-time founder, doesn't. So we're helping to bridge that gap. And so those are the main...
I bet that's really helpful.
Yep. Those are the main two things I'm working on. I also, advise and consult with a bunch of other startups.
All right. Well, we will have some links in the show notes to find out more about you, your podcast, all those things. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
That's been a lot of fun, Matt. Really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Take care.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.
do it.